Dr. F.A.C. Olus, Rule 6. Dr. Olus, were you ever asked to go for any of this kind of voluntary labor work?
No, somehow I escaped this. But those who had to go had to do such things as clearing the mess, the rubble, leveling roads, taking away, closing up potholes, clearing drains, and doing general menial work. But other details, I'm sorry, I do not know much of.
Do you have any friends who were involved in this kind of work for the Japanese?
Well, some of my neighbors, yes, and that was it. They called it voluntary work, but it just wasn't voluntary, it was compulsory.
Did you know why your neighbors were asked to go and you were exempted?
Don't know, really. I suppose it's luck of the draw. Luck of the draw.
Dr. Ulis, did you know who were the community leaders during that time?
Yes, I know in among the Eurasians, Dr. C.J. Pagler was one of the leading figures. Then Dr. Lim Boon Keng among the Chinese, Mr. G.H. Kiat played an important role. I think it's mentioned by Shinozaki in his book how he started the Sports Association. But I was, of course, involved with the Eurasians more than being a Eurasian myself. And it was, in fact, Pagler who was the leading light. And there were others, you see, who were sort of collared by the Japanese to keep an eye, so to speak, on the Eurasians, because they viewed us all with suspicion because of our Occidental heritage. They considered us as, in fact, potential enemies, and they were very wary of us. So they put the onus on a few people to see that the Eurasian community listened to their dictates, did nothing to harm the Japanese administration. And one of them who has a sort of an indirect role in this was my father-in-law, Dr. Van Kylenberg. He was a leading medical practitioner. He didn't volunteer, but he was more subpoenaed, well, not subpoenaed, he was not subpoenaed. He was directed by the military, MAD, which is Military Administrative Department, to work for them. And whether he liked it or not, he did. And while he was there, he was told that it was his responsibility to see that, among other people, that the Eurasians behave themselves. It was a difficult thing for him, I know, because he used to confide in me. And because of this, his position, and because of the directives that he had from these Japanese superiors, people began to think that he was a collaborator, totally pro-Japanese, collaborating with them, and they even believed that he gave information on some of the people who were eventually taken in by the Kempeitai. This was completely untrue. What he did do was to warn a few individuals who he had reason to believe were doing the things which are completely counter the directives of the Japanese administration. things like listening to shortwave radios, passing information of the war in other countries, in Europe and elsewhere, and trying to contact the prisoners of war in Changi, especially when groups of them went out to do manual labor in the streets. They'd try to sneak out and pass them food. Some succeeded, but I mean, you know, the sort of a thing would have got the members of the community into trouble had they been caught. So he'd warned them about this, and this was misinterpreted as his being acting on behalf of the Japanese. In fact, it was for their protection that he told them. And in fact, some of the people who he did warn were taken in by the Kempeitai. And the people believed that it was he who told on them, and it wasn't true, not true at all. Among the other leaders, well, I don't know, there's Herman de Souza, who had something to do with education. His father, Herman de Souza Sr., used to be a great poker friend of my father's, Poker Kaki. He actually was one who went with Bishop de Valls to explore Bahao as a possible site for the Eurasians, who the Japanese wanted to get out of Singapore, because we were all viewed with suspicion. And in fact, we were all, of course, terribly all pro-allies and all definitely anti-Japanese. But it's a matter of it's manifesting your feelings, you know? It's being reasonable about it, being realistic about it, being cautious about it. And some had this feeling of bravado. They thought they were smart by going around and openly condemning the Japanese, which is the wrong thing to do. Some of them suffered the consequences as a result of that. It's not a thing to have done. I mean, the thing was to keep quiet about it, keep your feelings pent up. And this is what my father-in-law was trying to tell them all the time. And it's what he told me, and it succeeded because I was a young chap full of, you know, bravado myself. But I did realize that it was important toe the line, though not with an enthusiastic way. You just had to do what you were told to do. What else could you do? How could you say no to these masters who had come and occupied Singapore? So it was with great relief, I think, that many of us heard about Fujigo, the settlement, to get out of Singapore, to get out of the possibility of being taken by the Kempeitai. And I think now I'm going on to this topic that you want to ask me about.
And before we go into Bahao, those people that you mentioned, Herman de Souza and his father, and your father-in-law, what positions did they have in the Eurasian Welfare Association?
That I don't know. But I think if you read my father-in-law's book, you'll find that he was representative of the Eurasian community, that he went to functions. For example, there was a dinner for Yamashita, and he was there, and so on. But what particular role he played, I don't think my father-in-law was a very active member of this body. He was, I'm not sure what position he had there.
Could you give us some examples of the directives that he might have received from the Japanese regarding what he should do?
No, I suppose he was told that the Eurasian community it was a community which is likely to spread propaganda, anti-Japanese propaganda. They're likely to get information about the progress of the war in the European zone or in the Asian zone, Pacific zone, and pass the world around, sort of boost up the morale of people. And they're quite right. I mean, they're the people who were active in this. They set up, they had clandestine radio sets and so on. And there was a danger, he was told, that if they were ever caught, the whole community would suffer. And I mean, they were not fooling. And so my father-in-law knew the circumstances. He knew the consequences. And therefore, he was always on tenterhooks.
All these were sort of general instructions from the Japanese. Do you remember whether there were any specific policy or that the Japanese wanted the Eurasian community to take, to follow?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was just that they were to listen to all their requirements, try to become pro-Japanese and so on. Every other member of the community, they were required to learn Nippongo. Some of us made a serious effort to learn it because we realized that it would be of benefit to us and our families. But there were others who were just stubborn about it. They just would not do anything about it. They had this defiant attitude. Many of them were defiant, which is stupid at that time. What could that? I mean, there was no recourse, you know. And so this is why, because there were a fairly high percentage of such individuals among the Eurasian community, that we were picked out as a dangerous lot.
Did you know at that time what was the specific role of the Eurasian Welfare Association in the community? Were there any things that were being done for the community?
I think I really don't know the details, but I should imagine that the main role was to look after the destitute, to help those who were badly off, those who couldn't help themselves. And there were many like that.
Do you remember, for instance, whether there were people who went to the association for help to locate, to get a job or something like that?
No, I don't know.
What do you think was the Eurasian's opinion of the Eurasian Welfare Association during that time?
Personally, I thought it was a good thing because, I mean, if it was trying to help the Eurasian community, and I think they were genuine in that, they were doing a good job. It was a much-needed body.
Did you know what were the feelings among your other friends or relatives regarding the association?
No, they did not. I care very much about this association.
How was the relationship among the members of the different communities at that time?
I think the relationship was one of harmony because we were all in the same boat. There were certain individuals, certain sections, I wouldn't say sections, certain people who we sort of didn't trust very much, who we believed may be informers, you know. I think there was a good feeling of comradeship amongst all members of the community. There was not I think that was, this is probably a time when communalism began to simmer down. During the British occupation, communalism was very strong, and I think it's a bad thing. And this is what I like about today, when communalism is now so minimal. I've never been communalistic myself. I mean, I'm Eurasian, but I mean, I don't move around with Eurasians and nobody else but Eurasians. My best friends are Chinese. The best Eurasians that I know are my own relatives, my nephews and nieces, and you know. But I'm not communalistic. But during the Japanese occupation, there was more like a knitting, communion of the various communities. They got together because we're all on the same boat. All had our same problems. All shared the same fears. All shared the same hopes that tomorrow maybe there would be some evidence that the Allies would be coming back.
What kind of people would others be suspicious of as informers?
I think people who were holding responsible positions in police force, people say who had no rank and suddenly were elevated to high ranks, that would be one or two. By word of mouth, people working in the municipality. And my father-in-law quotes an example of a chap who was trying to fish something out of him when he went to collect his coal rations, trying to get him into trouble, and so on, you know. But we are always wary of the person we did not know. I mean, I couldn't go to somebody and say, oh, look, have you heard the latest, you know? The British the Americans have landed in some place or other. You know, no. You didn't dare talk to that, to anybody, except your best friends, people you knew. I think it was foolish, but people did. Some people did and got into trouble.
Who was trying to get your father-in-law into trouble? You mentioned something.
It's inside here in his book. When he went to collect his ration of charcoal, somebody put a question to him, did you hear that? Oh, I can't quite remember, but it was some sort of a leading question.
Dr. Willis, coming to yourself, you mentioned that did you go back to the College of Medicine to continue your study?
Well, when the British surrendered, I was just a third year dental student, getting ready to sit for my examination, and everything came to an abrupt stop. And of course, when the Japanese came in, there was no more King Edward VII College of Medicine. There was a period of time when there was no signs of any resuscitation of this College of Medicine. Although the senior students, those who were about to graduate, were asked to report back to Chobuyan, that is the Kanankarabar Hospital, and they were allowed to continue with a course, which were conducted by senior local teachers at that time, like Dr. Hari Das, late President Shears, and a few others, Clarence Smith. And they subsequently took their examinations and graduated as doctors during the Japanese occupation, and they were allowed to practice in hospitals and in private practice. But we who were in their non-clinical years, subclinical years, didn't have any opportunity of starting. Then they came up with the circular, or was it in the newspapers? I cannot quite remember. That they were starting a medical school, and all old medical, dental, and pharmaceutical students were told that they could go back and report and they would get going as a medical school, so all of us would become medical students. Well, and so a number of us responded, I mean, not knowing what the future was going to be, how long it was going to take, what the school was going to be all about, how it's going to be conducted, no idea. So we all thought that, yeah, fine, we've spent so many years of our lives studying, let's go back and study further. So we reported, and the school, something Daigaku is university, was housed at the Tan Tock Seng Hospital. And all the wards were now empty. Well, I remember they had tin sheds, they were tin sheds. And that was the dental school. But the only lectures that we ever got were to study Nipongo, classes in Nipongo, and propaganda thrown down our throats by instructors who are not doctors. Every morning we'd have to go and do some exercise, and before exercise we had to pay respects to the Japanese flag, sing the national anthem, and bow. And then we would have to build the school. We'd have to carry bricks and heavy things and start making certain structures. And there was no didactic course per se, no syllabus, no organization. Nothing to offer. I think they might have been just wanting to get started, but not know how to get started. And of course, there was the language difficulties. I mean, we weren't so fluent in Japanese. They insisted that Japanese must be the medium of instruction. And so it was quite a farce, actually. Quite a farce. We were all given uniforms, had uniforms, khaki uniforms with a peak hat, and we'd cycle to report for class, and I put class in inverted commas. If we ever saw a military car passing with a blue flag or an officer's car, we'd have to stop and salute with our uniform, you know. But it was not. It was not a medical school. So after a short while, I and many others just left. And from that school were also people from Malaysia and also from Indonesia. There were chaps brought out from Indonesia, potential medical students from Indonesia as well as Malaysia. But I don't know what happened to it, but I left.
Do you know what happened to the College of Medicine, the King Edward VII College of Medicine?
Oh, the Japanese military took it over, and General Hospital became their military hospital, and all those buildings became part of their General Hospital. I don't know what they used them for, but it just didn't exist anymore during the Japanese occupation.
This new Japanese medical school, do you remember when did it start functioning?
Oh, a few months after the occupation, easily 6 months or so, must be more, because I wasn't there too long.
At that time, did you know who started this medical school?
It must have been the Director of Medical Services, Dr. Ando.
The purpose of starting this school again, was it made known to the people?
Oh, yes. Well, oh yes. I mean, it was to provide a continuation of education. The schools had opened up with a different complexion, all were biased towards Nippon outlook and ideals and propaganda, and so they had to have universities as well.
You mentioned those final year students were sent to Kanagawa Hospital.
Yes.
Whose instruction was that?
I think, again, the director of medical services then, Dr. Ando.
Did you know where was his office?
According to my father's book, it was in a municipal building. He was a director of medical services.
So for this medical school at Tan Tock Seng, which part of the hospital did all of you occupy?
Just a few of the third class wards, which were just zinc sheds, you know.
Who were the lecturers?
Japanese, only Japanese. And in fact, as I said, I can't recall any being a doctor. They were like sergeants in the army.
Were they in uniform?
Yes.
Do you remember what kind of uniforms were they wearing?
Military uniform. Japanese military uniform, khaki. So were the uniform that we got ourselves. Paramilitary uniforms.
What about the ranks of these so-called lecturers?
That I don't know. But as I said, nothing really was off the ground. There was no sort of a set course in biology or in anatomy or physiology or bacteriology. No such thing. All we were doing, what we virtually were, we were being pawns, you know. We were being fed Japanese propaganda. We were made to sing the Kimigayo. We were then made to do labor, hard labor, carrying bricks and things to build up walls and things. But nothing off the ground. I stayed out, but there were some who were boarders who stayed in.
What kind of Japanese propaganda